We've all been there, heading to the mall or the theater or dinner, and it ends up taking longer to find a parking space than it did to get there in the first place. This isn't just frustrating. It turns out all these cars driving in circles are bad for the climate and bad for the air we breathe. But writer Clive Thompson thinks that one of the answers to this parking problem is not so far in the future: self-driving cars. His new essay in Mother Jones Magazine is called No Parking Here, and he joins us now to discuss it. Welcome to Living on Earth, Clive.
Good to be here.
Clive, you say the average automobile spends the majority of its time sitting still. So if every driver is, say, sleeping the 8 hours out of every 24-hour period and presumably not driving, that's a lot of time in parking spaces. Tell me about the math here.
I mean, the math is pretty crazy. Your car spends 95% of its time sitting in one place. And here's the real problem is that you've got your car at home and it mostly just sits there. And then you drive it for a very brief time to work and it has to find a place to sit there, right? And then maybe you drive it a very brief time out to dinner, but it has to have a place to sit there. And then you drive back home. In each place where the car is sitting, there needs to be parking. And this becomes sort of an interesting sort of geometric problem. To accommodate the amount of time those cars sit there, our society had to build way more parking than there are cars, right? And the upshot is, you know, there are about 250 million cars and passenger trucks, light trucks in the country. But the estimates are that there's close to a billion parking spots. I calculated the square footage, square mileage, and it's basically about the size of Connecticut is how much parking we have in the U.S. And, you know, there are all sorts of problems that stem from that amount of parking. I guess on just an aesthetic level, parking is pretty ugly. I was talking to one architect during the story who said, there's a lot of books that are like the 10 best buildings in America or the 10 best bridges in America. There is no book of the 10 best parking lots in America because they're just ugly as sin, right? So they're ugly. They produce a lot of runoff, you know, like you get a big rain, hits this massive parking lot, water's got nowhere to go, so it rushes the edges and it just rips the topsoil off whatever field it encounters. So it causes these kind of environmental problems.
But wait a second. If an average vehicle is parked most of the time with the motor turned off, isn't that an environmental benefit that the thing isn't running?
You would hope so. But the problem is that actually parking lots encourage excessive driving because when people go to park in a city, they have trouble sometimes finding a parking spot, right? Because there's this congestion in a city. And so people will sort of circle around looking for parking. And studies show that it dramatically increases the amount of time we spend driving. In fact, my neighborhood in Brooklyn, they did a study. They found if you see cars driving past you, standing on a corner, see cars driving past you, 30 to 60% of those cars are circling looking for parking. They're not going anywhere. They are no longer transferring people from point A to point B. They are now just circling. And so what this means is that in a city, an enormous percentage of the carbon being put out by cars isn't getting people anywhere. It's just looking for parking.
And in your article, you say that the death of the ubiquitous parking space may be on its way thanks to self-driving cars.
Yes, yeah. There are some interesting trends afoot here. So here's the thing about self-driving cars is that it's likely that by the time these things get fully licensed to be on the road, which is, you know, 15, maybe 10, 15, 20 years now, they will probably be deployed not individually. Like it won't be like you or me buying a self-driving car. It'll probably be mostly fleets. Right? So, you know, your local taxi company will just buy 200 self-driving cars. Or the city might decide that it's going to create a kind of a public transit thing with cars. They'll buy 1,000 self-driving cars. Uber and Lyft, they are actively researching to build their own self-driving cars. So the theory is that actually self-driving cars will mostly be fleet-based. And that this will be quite interesting because, you know, you get a fleet of self-driving cars servicing a large or mid-sized town. And what you'd effectively have is a world where you need to go somewhere. You pull out your phone and you say, okay, I need a car. And the car sort of comes zipping right up to you. And maybe there's someone already in it. Like they're going, it's intelligent carpooling. They're kind of going in the same direction as you. You guys are going to split the cost. This is going to cost you almost nothing because you're sharing the cost. And so you'll still be taking cars all day long, but they won't be cars you own. They'll just be these fleets that are incredibly easy to get because there's just so many of them out there running around. And the thing about those cars is that they're not going to need to park ever. They will basically just be driving and driving and driving and driving around, ferrying people around in this very intelligent, efficient way. So this is the vision that I was surprised by this. I had thought that people were going to buy their own self-driving cars. But over and over again, the experts I talked to, the urban planning experts, the car experts, they see this as the legit. And it sort of makes sense when you think about it, because the truth is owning a car is expensive. You know, you got to find somewhere to put it. You got to pay for these repairs. And young people are buying far fewer cars than you would expect at their age. They are driving, personally, far fewer miles than you'd expect at their age. And they are, in fact, actually even less likely, significantly, to have their driver's licenses. So it's very, this is a cultural shift, which is also very interesting. So that's the kind of the 1-2 punch that's moving us towards the end of parking. Self-driving cars and a generation of people that actually are less interested in owning their own car.
So what happens to the ability to hang one's own personal set of dice from the mirror of the car, and then, you know, and let's face it, for older folks, you know, teenagers remember that when you got that license, it was, well, it was helpful in the dating game.
Yeah, no. This is a really interesting cultural shift. I'm 47, so I'm in my generation. I grew up in suburban Toronto, and you still, you know, we had a pretty good subway and bus system, but you still needed to get your driver's license for a certain level of autonomy and freedom. Because if you wanted to kind of move around the suburbs, you needed to be able to drive, get your family's car, take someone out on a date, you know. So I definitely grew up with the thing that the boomers grew up with, which is that the association that the car was kind of a rite of passage. It was you becoming a little more adult and having some autonomy and independence. That experience is far less common for young people. It's not gone. You know, if you live in a rural area, you still really need a car to get around. But more and more, younger people are living in more densely packed areas, and they're discovering that in those situations, they can really move around pretty easily without driving. The other thing about young people is that it's pushing them away from driving, is that they like using their phones. For them, autonomy is about having a phone, being able to communicate all day long when they want to. And you can't use your phone while you're driving. Those are rival activities, and they would rather use the phone than drive.
Hey, so what's your experience been like in a self-driving car?
It was very interesting. So I get inside this self-driving car in the parking lot of Google, and I'm in the back seat. In the front seat, there's an engineer in the driver's seat, not touching the wheel. The car starts driving off, and I'm looking in the front wheel, and basically, you know, the car is just, it's as if a ghost is driving it. The wheel is turning itself. And at first, it was, for the first like 3 or 4 minutes, it was pretty unsettling because it really feels weird to have no one, you know, no human driving that car. But it quickly became kind of boring because it turns out that Google's cars are very defensive drivers. And so, you know, we'd be driving along, you know, going along fairly fast, but the instant someone starts to edge out into our lane, our car would immediately slow down and give way. So in one sense, it actually very quickly became boring. And at first I thought, well, this is going to be hard to, you know, I'm trying to write a story. It's supposed to be exciting. But I became, you know, convinced that actually boring is what you want. You know, when it comes to driving, you want driving to be predictable and safe and boring. The one thing that most computer scientists and urban traffic experts say that will make them even safer is if there's actually a lot of them on the road. Because if all the cars are robotic, and if they can all talk to each other, well, then they can really start to, you know, optimize for good behavior and minimize bad behavior. You know, they aren't going to make any stupid calls. They're not going to make any emotional decisions. You could even do things. This is pretty funny. There's a guy at the University of Austin who's done these modelings where he says, well, you know, if you had all robot cars on the road, maybe you don't need stop signs. Because the cars can just sort of weave through each other, right? They can just go right into the intersection and just go right through and slow down and speed up to avoid other cars. And he's done these little animations showing what it looks like. And it's just wild. And the upside is the traffic really keeps moving. So one of the other weird upsides of self-driving cars is we could actually move around a lot more quickly and efficiently, which again reduces emissions because there is a huge amount of emissions that come from a car slowing down and then speeding up again at an intersection.
So one big benefit from self-driving cars would be to eliminate, essentially, parking spaces for vehicles. So what do you do with all that land that becomes available now?
Yeah, it's a super interesting question. I mean, most downtown cores are about 30% parking, right? So think about that. That's prime land. So what would you do if you freed up 31% fresh land to do something with? What would you do with it? Well, you know, maybe the city could finally do some of the things that we've always wanted to do. Like we could build more housing. Housing is a huge issue certainly in markets like overheated markets, San Francisco, Chicago, Boston, New York, desperate for more housing. Or you can convert some of it to parks. I mean, there's this little parklet program in San Francisco that's a real blast, where they let a merchant, if you want to, if you got a and you've got a coffee shop, you can pay the city a certain amount per year for the parking spot in front of your cafe, and you're allowed to turn it into a park. And so there's all these very funny little beautiful parks where people they've grassed it over and they put like, you know, a little tree in and stuff, or they maybe put up a bench and there's kind of a sitting area. And if you were able to make it green, if you could, you know, throw in plants and throw in grass in that area, you could also really cool cities down, because all that 31% it's all asphalt, and that heats up a city. It's the, what they call the urban heat island effect. Sun hits the asphalt, heats it up. It's like a battery storing heat. Sun goes down, it keeps the city hot at night. Well, if you have grass and trees, it doesn't do that. It cools things down a lot. That would make it way more fun and livable, and again, have fantastic environmental effects, because now you're doing much less air conditioning, using less electricity for air conditioning. So, you know, the sort of fun things that begin to cascade out of getting rid of parking, it's delightful, and there's all these different layers.
Yeah, on the real estate side, I mean, you could even take it to the bank. Famously, here in Boston a couple of years ago, there was an auction of two rare tandem parking spaces. So in other words, you know, front to back, behind a building on Commonwealth Avenue in the ritzy Back Bay neighborhood. Those spots went for $560,000, more than $500,000.
Exactly. That's how, in a really overheated market, that, you know, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars worth of land. And I mean, and I mean, the one thing is, you know, if we want to manage this well, and cities have to start thinking now, because, you know, they may have to make these decisions 15 years now. What are they going to do with that stuff? And there'll definitely be a lot of interests pushing, you know, there'll be developers that want it. There'll be school boards that want it. There'll be park people that want it. So, you know, we got to start having these conversations now so that we make reasoned and good, equitable decisions 15 years down the line, if and when this starts happening.
Clive, how do you see this system dovetailing with mass transit?
In one sense, you can already see it happening, which is that down in San Francisco, where Uber is really big, a very significant chunk of their rides, I think almost one third of their rides, begin or end at a station on the rail lines. So what people are using Uber for is to get them to public transit. And so what public transit really needs is to understand, they're trying to wrestle with what's the demand for these services, because they actually want to build public transit in a way that works with these mobility things to actually enhance both, right? You could easily imagine that if you now were confident as a city that you didn't have to worry maybe quite so much about building some bus lines, because these types of services were going to be useful in well-to-do neighborhoods, you could focus the bus lines on areas that where people are less likely to use these services, but you could also build out rail confident that people will be able to get to and from the rail more quickly. The other thing cities are thinking about is, okay, there is a significant chunk of the population that is unbanked, right? So they do not have bank cards, they do not have credit cards in more low-income sectors. Well, the price of these on-demand ride services is dropping quite sharply. You know, if you do an Uber pool, you know, you might only pay $3 or $4 for a ride. That actually gets it. Lower income families could find it an amenable way to get around, but they need a card to participate. So that, I know the city of San Francisco is already thinking, well, so are there things we could do? Could we set up some sort of card system that would work with public funds or whatnot to help get these people so they can actually participate in this? So really what you're seeing is the public transit systems are thinking, how can we, if this is a massed movement trend, how can we work with it so that it actually aids our goal of moving people around efficiently?
Clive, give us the Rip Van Winkle report here. You fall asleep, presumably not at the wheel, and you wake up now in a couple of decades. What do you expect to see on city streets?
You know, I think 20 years from now, if the predictions that everyone has been giving me hold up, here's what we're going to see. We'll see cities where you look at the street and the street is really full of a lot of traffic. Like, this is not the absence of traffic. If anything else, there might be even more cars whizzing around. But they're never stopping. They're never parking. You would decide, okay, I need to go across town. You pull out your phone, and within like 15 to 20 seconds, a car would pull up and get you. Like, not 5 minutes. You know, we're talking seconds. A car would pull up. You jump in, there's someone there. You go across town. You get across town pretty quickly. And, you know, you'd go through these intersections that maybe don't have lights anymore. You just zip right through. And when you got out of the car, you might be stepping onto what is essentially a little park on the edge of the road, right? You know, because that's what we've done with that space now. The other thing, though, you'd find is that there would definitely be some, probably be some very significant labor dislocation. You'd wake up in a world where millions and millions of people who used to be employed in jobs that paid, you know, not great, but pretty well, to drive cars around, to drive trucks around, they do not have those jobs anymore. And you could imagine that going pretty poorly if there's not decent public policy to try and figure out how to encourage economic growth that gives those people jobs. If they don't have jobs, we could have an awful lot of turmoil. That world, you could be your great mobility, but at the cost of significant economic and social upheaval.
Clive Thompson is a freelance journalist, blogger, and science and technology writer. His piece entitled No Parking Here appears in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Thank you so much for taking the time today, Clive.
Great conversation. I had a lot of fun.